Hello, you're listening to the Sports Illustrated program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. In today's program, we're going to be continuing the March issue of Sports Illustrated. Let's get started. We're going to start things off with the cover article of this issue, 23 and Me, by Greg Bishop. You know about the elite power, speed, and skill that helped Myles Garrett become the NFL's new single-season sack king. But it also took some big dreams and a little self-doubt to establish football's new magic number. Myles Garrett had a dream 5 months ago. He has a lot of those, hundreds of dreams, that descend nightly, random, and pointed, and pointless, and inspirational, and pure fantasy. Garrett remembers his dreams, too, which makes him a high dream recaller. HDRs, research says, display higher brain activity, tend to daydream and enjoy fantasy worlds, are creative and more open to experiences. That's him, Myles Garrett, the dreamer. This dream, he's outside a hotel where he has never stayed, in a beautiful, wintry landscape. His girlfriend, snowboarder Chloe Kim, two-time Olympic gold medalist, is talking to him, but standing in front of him, her back turned. Garrett describes this in Los Angeles on January 20th. He's less than 48 hours removed from a flight from Switzerland to Lax, and he's describing how the moment in that dream, which he hadn't considered since the morning after, had helped IRL 3 of 4 days earlier, exactly as envisioned. I get deja vu a bunch, he says, or I guess I dreamed it and it's hard for me to recall that moment until it happened. On the night of January 3rd, the Browns' defensive end nodded off in Cincinnati. On the eve of the final game of the season, he was sitting on 22 sacks, a half sack behind the NFL single-season record since the stat was officially recognized 4 decades ago. Another one, and he'd have more than any pass rusher ever to lock eyes on a quarterback and grunt like it's time for dinner. His dream that night, Garrett is on the field, chasing Bengals QB Joe Burrow and the record. Not just for himself, but also for his teammates, the Cleveland D-line room, defensive coordinator Jim Schwartz, his parents, siblings, Kim. But he cannot get that elusive number 23. Play after play, amid double teams and triple teams, and chip blocks, he's come close, but never can quite corral Burrow. Just before Garrett woke up on a day he would remember forever, his subconscious flashed a dream montage. This tabloid was failure, disappointment, and not just failure, but how it felt to fail. With the world watching, while on the precipice of a record that is among the NFL's most hallowed. The last thing Garrett recalls from that dream is an image. Him, sitting on his couch alone, watching news clips about the mark he almost broke. I remember a sense of, like, dread in my chest and stomach, Garrett says. This was the last opportunity, and I let myself down. I let my family, my friends down, knowing that this was a moment I hoped to share with everyone. Then he woke up. There's no way, Garrett promised himself, no way he'd let that happen. Michael Strahan assumed the single-season sack throne 24 seasons ago. Nothing like it, he says, even now. Strahan, a co-anchor of Good Morning America, an analyst of Fox NFL Sunday, and the host of the 100,000 Pyramid, has become America's uncle since his retirement in 2008. Ubiquitous and beloved, but he says nary a day has passed without someone reminding him of that 2001 season and his 22 and a half sacks. Strangers mention it more often than his Super Bowl 42 triumph with the Giants. It's cool, man, honestly. A really cool record to have, Strahan says. He's on the phone from New York, and the elation in his voice isn't the result of modern media supremacy. It's for the new sack king, his mentee, who refers to Strahan as Big Unk. The mark doesn't define your career, Strahan says, but it puts a nice little stamp on it. I've done something that no one else has ever done in a game that has so much history. Elite pass rushers debate this record more than anyone. Sacks arrive late to the NFL's numerical bonanza. They weren't officially counted until 1982. Strahan considered Deacon Jones, who retired in 1974, and his third on the unofficial career list, 173 and a half, his mentor. Strahan knew Lawrence Taylor and Bruce Smith, too. Jones once told Strahan he had 100 sacks in 1 year and insisted that he, Deacon Jones, was the real all-time sack leader and not Smith, who retired in 2003 with 200. This debate among retired pass rushers confirms Strahan's already firm opinion that this record, for any defender, is the most prominent anybody wants. He cackles as he jokes about tackles, the vast majority of which are instantly forgotten, and interceptions, which carry the same impact, but not often the same pizzazz. Sacks are sexy. Sacks are powerful. Sacks are art. Sacks are science. Sacks are violent. Sacks demand celebrations. Pass rushers are almost always dreamers. How else could anyone handle the job? It's many hazards and it's many disappointments. Each sack is like a goal in tightly contested World Cup final. Elation possible on any play, but rare. The product of dozens of failed attempts. And that willingness, or delusion, embedded in these chasers to fail and fail and fail, and still rush and rush and rush. It's so freaking hard, man, Strahan says. It's every play, as if it's your last play on Earth. On the morning of January 4th, Garrett didn't tell anyone about his dream. Giving voice to it struck Garrett like putting it into the universe. Instead, he sent one text to a fellow Browns defensive lineman. It wasn't written in all caps, but dripped with the same urgency. Get ready. The first half against the Bengals wasn't like the dream. It was the dream. Play after play, there was Burrow. Close, but never close enough. At halftime, the overthinking started. Garrett wanted history so badly that the very act of seeking this history had infiltrated his mind and grown into, his words, fear and anxiety. Then, that doubt creeps in, Garrett says. He acknowledged that doubt, understood where it came from, and clocked back in. In L.A., looking back, Garrett admits that some of his dreams are night terrors and even more horrific. He's writing a story about those that will become a graphic novel. Two quarters remained. Garrett wasn't supposed to do any of this, really. If greatness lurked in his DNA, his body once hid it well. Growing up in Arlington, Texas, he was the antithesis of what he would become. Undersized, tall, and skinny, with flat feet. He had surgery on both feet in his youth, surgeons building out arches and releasing tension in the tightest of his tendons with a small incision. This stoked his insecurities, which led to body image issues, which further stoked his insecurities. Football transformed him. When he stepped onto the field, everything, Garrett says, just sheds off, and that guy that y'all see is just super amazing. There's a process for this transformation. On the nights before games, Garrett, now 6'4", 272-pound behemoth, prefers watching Godzilla movies. Then he pictures himself destroying whatever hapless offense happens to be up next. Like Godzilla destroys cities or monsters, he says. The best offensive linemen draw him further into character. Garrett envisions those individual matchups as similar to heavyweight kaiju bouts, immense in scale, epic, and destructive. Like Mega Kaiju from Pacific Rim, Uprising, where three of the most powerful kaiju combine into one triple hybrid monster, the Mega Kaiju. It's said to redefine destructive potential, kind of like Miles Garrett. Last offseason forced Garrett to plump the depths of his football soul. Everywhere he went, strangers told him he deserved better than the Browns had given him. That his dominance needed to be showcased, and to be fully showcased, he needed wins as well as sacks. The city of Cleveland means more to him than Garrett can probably express. He wanted to return to win in Cleveland, for Cleveland, but it didn't take his immediate knowledge of the Browns organization to wonder if that might be possible. while his agent, Nicole Lynn, negotiated with decision makers. Garrett vacillated between options. At one point, a trade was requested. The Browns insisted they'd never trade him. They demonstrated that commitment with a contract extension last March that at the time made Garrett the highest paid defensive player in NFL history, with more than $123 million guaranteed. I feel like I got what I earned, and that was the market I had set from the level of consistency I had displayed, he says. I wasn't trying to hit them over the head, and I wanted something that would still structure in a way in which we could bring in talent and try to win. I asked about something I'd heard back in April, that he had taken less money to stay in Cleveland. Yes, he confirmed, that's true. No, he didn't feel it necessary to shoot down the most common sentiment attached to his historic season, that he stayed for the money and cared primarily about his statistics. If I would have left, they would have said I was ring-chasing, he says. If I stay, they say I stayed for the money. He had larger issues to address before the season even started, like a shorthanded offseason thanks to another surgery, two actually, one on each foot. The pain in each never went away. Throughout his football career, his feet became inflamed, making each step so painful that Garrett limped through the 2024 season after considering not playing at all. He started every week, adding 14 sacks and a career-high 22 tackles for loss while making first-team All-Pro. Again. After the procedures, Garrett felt immediate relief. During joint practices with Philadelphia in August, he went full out, each rep, sometimes irritating his opposition. He wanted to scrap with stud left tackle Jordan Matisha in a meaningless, informal heavyweight kaiju bout. I just don't get the opportunities, regardless of how great the tackles are, Garrett says, sounding wistful almost of a scrimmage that redefined his destructive potential for 25. I mean, the Eagles have some special tackles, and I can beat anyone one-on-one. After that practice, Matisha told reporters that Garrett sometimes presented as impossible to block. He would start in a four-point stance, but maintain it for 4 or 5 yards, while moving at speeds humans his size simply never dream of, Matisha asked. What was he supposed to do? Fall on top of Garrett, who might just lift and carry his 6'8 frame into the quarterback? I don't think that would work, Garrett says, his smile sly and telling. You know what I love about him? Strahan asks. He's everything that you think an athlete probably isn't. Strahan is speaking directly to Garrett's many interests, that elite functional connectivity. Critics, Strahan says, often twist the wide totality of Garrett's passion into sentiments both disdain. That he doesn't love football, that he cares about individual statistics more than Cleveland's record, which Strahan says is completely wrong. I don't think people understand just how awesome he is, because they really haven't gotten a chance to know him, because his teams haven't had the success or the spotlight to highlight him more. Watching Garrett play can unspool like a dream sequence, start with his size, or as Strahan puts it, massive, like I don't know how, what mama was doing with that breast milk. To stand that tall, stretch that wide, be that thick, and still run like a cheetah. Doesn't seem fair. And the flexibility that Matisha highlighted, the basketball backboards Garrett has shattered, the times he has leaped over blockers. This nerd, the skinny kid born flat-footed, is now a specimen. He's versatile. Garrett rushes from either edge, from inside as a defensive tackle, or standing up like a linebacker. He's not reliant on one move. Garrett utilizes speed, power, hand swipes, spins, dips, and rips, but and jerks, a football Euro step, even a technique that looks like he's dribbling a basketball through his legs. He's complete, especially this past season, his best year yet in stopping the run. He's dominant, but not an exact comparison to those who sacked before. He does everything, and that's what's mind-blowing, Strahan says. Power, speed, changing direction, agility, his ability to lean on a rift, moving like he's right off the ground, his ability to come inside, open at the hips. all these things that you're limited, usually, in only being able to do one or two. He does what Reggie White did. He does what Bruce Smith did. He does what I did. The one thing we became known for, he does. And there's not one thing he's known for, because he can do it all. Most weeks, that's the gig. Do it all. His titanic clashes aren't typically one-on-one. I might be the most double-team player ever, the new Sack King says. I don't think anyone else has seen the kind of packages and protections I've seen. Some teams, he says, shift the offensive line in his direction. He'll meet a guard and a tackle, with a tight end behind them, ready to leak out, or a running back, ready to chip away. In the most extreme vision of his calculus, he'll face a guard, a tackle, a tight end, and a back. This diet of triple and quadruple teams began increasing about 5 seasons ago, he says. As for direct rare mono-a-mono, Garrett estimates he gets 3 or 4 of these a game. When only one blocker stands between him and the quarterback, he guesses the offense will run a fake or assumes they have something quick planned, like a screen. Sometimes, when the opportunity arises, he'll think things like, "You can't be serious. You haven't given this to me all day." Inside the Browns' defensive line meeting room, the number on the whiteboard reminded Garrett and his teammates of their shared ambition. Garrett had said before the season he wanted 24 sacks. After 2 games, and 3.5 of those, he upped it to 25, which he scribbled on the whiteboard and his wrist tape. Garrett added 0.5 sack in the Browns' first win, Green Bay, Week 3. Then went sackless for 3 weeks. This drought didn't raise any internal alarms. He sprained his left ankle in the 3rd or 4th quarter of Week 4 in Detroit. No sacks didn't equate to abort plan. He snapped the drought against Miami, but still didn't feel like himself. He went to his coaches. He wanted more practice reps, like all of them. "I didn't like how I'd been playing," he says now. "I wanted to knock the rust out and make sure I was healthy and back to my standard." In Week 8 at New England, Garrett doubled his season sack total in 1 game. Down went Drake May on the Patriots' first possession. Garrett registered 5 sacks against the Patriots, breaking his own Brown single-game record. Garrett's only comparison for this spree dated back to high school. He played against a team that featured a friend. They'd competed in track together, at quarterback. He dropped his friend 9 times. His dominance so complete, so thorough, that Garrett had apologized to him for years. He was sick, Garrett says, because he also knew they would have to see me in their basketball season. He never forgot what wideout Odell Beckham Jr. told him back in 2001. "There are 4 quarters. Who says you can't get a sack in every one of them?" 1 more sack. The next week, against the Jets. 4 sacks against the Ravens, 3 more against the Raiders. Garrett had 18 sacks at that point, collecting 14 in 1 5-game stretch marked an NFL first. He still had 6 games remaining. In the final weeks of 2025, Garrett implored everyone around him to remain calm, stay composed. "I'm chasing this thing that every other team is trying to avoid," he says, which left only the finale in Cincinnati. Through 3 quarters, the Bengals stymied Garrett. He touched Burrow, bumped Burrow, chased Burrow. He blitzed standing up, like a linebacker. He rushed from the inside. "If you get an opportunity," he continued to remind himself, "make the most of it." After halftime in Cincinnati, when the dream resurfaced, Garrett tried to shift his mindset. "I've already told myself it was going to happen," he says. "That it's a matter of time. You're going to get one. You're due." That's all he needed. 1 play. 1 rush. And he delivered in the 4th quarter. Cleveland led 17-12. On the first down at the Browns 45, Garrett timed the snap. So well, he almost jumped offside. His get-off on this play, 0.23 seconds. His single fastest jump this season, per Next Gen Stats. Cincinnati tackle Orlando Brown Jr. stood between Garrett and history. Garrett swam past him like Michael Phelps, reaching Burrow before he could begin his reads. Garrett turned that corner only 8 yards beyond the line of scrimmage. Total time, 2.3 seconds from snap to celebration, or 1.4 seconds faster than the NFL average. He raised both arms skyward, then dropped them, then bowed. Teammates crowded around, raising him onto their shoulders, something that Garrett says he didn't know was possible. No one had ever picked him up off the ground before. He jogged over to the stands and embraced those who matter most. The montage that ran through Garrett's mind was the opposite of his dream. He thought about the toiling he did in Dallas last offseason, alongside fellow elite pass rushers Micah Parsons, Will Anderson Jr., and several Cleveland teammates. He loved them all and insists there's no record without his fellow Browns and their persistence. They fought deep into a miserable season, through injuries, minus the history and acclaim that went to Garrett. That's what screamed amid the celebration. Garrett wasn't featured by himself. Those teammates implored him to step forward, take a bow, step into the spotlight all alone. They called for something grand, one of his signatures. That's not what Garrett wanted, nor what the record meant to him. I just wanted to give thanks, he says. True Media provides some necessary context. Garrett notched a sack on almost 5% of his snaps in the 2025 season, the highest rate posted by any defender with more than 500 snaps in the past 5 years. His average get-off of 0.711 seconds ranked first among qualified rushers. Only 3 of his 23 sacks came on plays where the Browns blitzed, which meant that 20 of his sacks were on non-blitz dropbacks, or 4 more than any other player in any other season over the last decade. He was double-teamed, meanwhile, or chip-blocked, on 186 of his rushes, the NFL's highest season tally since 2018. Garrett became the first player since sacks were made official to record at least 12 in 6 straight seasons. He is also the only player with at least 10 sacks in each of his last 8 seasons. He holds the record for most sacks ever by any player under the age of 30. He made first-team All-Pro as unanimous selection. He was near lock to win the NFL Defensive Player of the Year for a second time in 3 seasons, too. No defender has ever won more than 3. And only 3 players, Lawrence Taylor, J.J. Watt, Aaron Darnold, have done that. Garrett only turned 30 in late December. Garrett isn't one of those people who say they listen to every musical genre. He actually does. His tastes, ranging from Journey, Boston, and Led Zeppelin, to Marvin Gaye, Howard Melvin, and the Blue Notes, Earth, Wind and Fire, and Teddy Pendergrass. Even while conducting an interview, music plays softly from the phone in his pants pocket. Garrett has come to see pass rushers and pass rushing as the NFL's version of karaoke. Different styles, different voices, like Von Miller and his ability to manipulate his body so masterfully, Garrett says, that he's basically Luther Vandross. Garrett is versatile, like Reggie White, but not as powerful as the best power rusher that ever played. White was like Aretha Franklin. He boomed. Garrett sees himself as Steve Perry, Journey's frontman at the band's peak. He's not as graceful as Miller, but he can finesse, smooth, and cat-like. He can also rock out with the best of them. Most guys excel at one or two things, Garrett says, and the truly exceptional have no fear in one thing or do multiple things at an elite level. What's possible for Garrett in future seasons cannot be contained any more than him. I still think 30 sacks is out there, he says. I still think 25 is out there next year. Soon, Garrett will climb above his career ranking. He's currently tied for 20th on the official all-time list with Dwight Freeney at 125.5, and debates will shift from single-season records to career ones. Strahan, for one, believes Garrett can break Smith's record. Garrett must draw a critical delineation there. The record was awesome, a goal, but not the goal. not what he wants most. Signing with the Jordan brand in January was sweet and symmetric, given the 23 sacks, but Cleveland fired coach Kevin Stefanski after the season, signaling a new direction for the franchise. Garrett's goal remains unchanged. He is committed to winning. The Browns must be too. At his Sports Illustrated cover shoot, Garrett donned Terminator-style sunglasses and wore a leather jacket with no shirt underneath. This man, born with flat feet, skinny and self-conscious, uncomfortable in social situations, a little nerdy, is now that guy. He makes Arnold Schwarzenegger look like a little person, Strahan says. After the celebrations on the day he set a new single-season sack record, Garrett played I Wonder by Kanye West as he walked into the news conference. I've been waiting on this my whole life, and I wonder. These dreams be waking me up at night. You're listening to the Sports Illustrated program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ben. Thanks again for listening. The next article I'll be reading is Let's Make a Deal. Ah, spring. When a football fan's fancy turns from TDs to AAV, with free agency around the corner, look for these 50 players to be the most sought after on the market, by Gilberto Manzano and Matt Verderame. Number 1. George Pickens, Cowboys wide receiver. Projected contract, 4 years, $120 million. Pickens was traded by Pittsburgh to Dallas for a third-round pick last offseason, a move that helped turn him into one of the league's top receivers. A 2022 second-rounder out of Georgia, he amassed 93 catches for 1,429 yards receiving and 9 touchdowns with the Cowboys. That yardage total ranked third behind only the Seahawks' Jackson Smith, Nick Bieba, and the Rams' Puka Nacka. Without question, the 24-year-old is in line for a long-term deal with north of $25 million per year and could challenge the $100 million guaranteed threshold as well. Number 2. Trey Hendrickson, Bengals edge. Projected contract, 3 years, $105 million. Number 3. Tyler Linderbaum, Ravens center. Projected contract, 4 years, $76 million. Number 4. Alec Pierce, Colts wide receiver. Projected contract, 3 years, $70 million. Number 5. Breece Hall, Jets running back. Projected contract, 3 years, $40 million. Number 6. Jalen Phillips, Eagles edge. Projected contract, 3 years, $55 million. Number 7. Daniel Jones, Colts quarterback. Projected contract, 3 years, $135 million. In 2025, Jones threw for 3,101 yards in 13 games, but his stock fell after a season-ending Achilles injury in December. He also dealt with a fractured fibula during his team's second-half freefall, and it didn't help that Jones needed monster performances from running back Jonathan Taylor to be at his best. Still, there's a shot he'll return to Indy. The Colts went all-in last season by trading 2 first-round picks for cornerback Sauce Gardner, and may not want to start over with a new QB. Number 8. Quay Walker, Packers linebacker. Projected contract, 3 years, $40 million. Walker was the best version of himself in 2025. After his fifth-year option was declined, he had a career high of 128 tackles, including 8 for loss, despite missing 3 games. He added 2.5 sacks, 7 quarterback hits, and 5 passes defended. A 2022 first-round pick out of Georgia, the 25-year-old Walker could still be improving. It will be difficult for Green Bay to let him walk away in free agency. Number 9. John Franklin Myers, Broncos defensive lineman. Projected contract, 3 years, $42 million. Number 10, Rashid Walker, Packers offensive tackle. Projected contract, 4 years, $80 million. Number 11, Braden Smith, Colts offensive tackle. Projected contract, 3 years, $50 million. Number 12, Jalen Watson, Chiefs cornerback. Projected contract, 3 years, $40 million. Number 13, Alante Taylor, Saints cornerback. Projected contract, 3 years, $35 million. Number 14, Malik Willis, Packers QB. Projected contract, 2 years, $50 million. Number 15, Kenneth Walker III, Seahawks running back. Projected contract, 3 years, $33 million. Number 16, Kyle Pitts, Falcons tight end. Projected contract, 4 years, $72 million. Number 17, Travis Etienne Jr., Jaguars running back. Projected contract, 3 years, $30 million. Number 18, Wandell Robinson, Giants wide receiver. Projected contract, 2 years, $35 million. Number 19, Mike Evans, Buccaneers wide receiver. Projected contract, 1 year, $15 million. Number 20, Devin Lloyd, Jaguars linebacker. Projected contract, 3 years, $60 million. Number 21, Rashid Shaheed, Seahawks wide receiver. Projected contract, 2 years, $30 million. Number 22, Rick Woolen, Seahawks cornerback. Projected contract, 4 years, $72 million. Number 23, Odaf Owe, Chargers edge. Projected contract, 4 years, $64 million. Owe shot up the free agent rankings after making a quick impact with the Chargers following his mid-season trade from the Ravens. The 2021 first-round pick had many highs and lows in Baltimore, including a 10-sack 24 season, before struggling at the start of this year. Perhaps the Chargers will aim to retain him because Owe found a productive role in their defense, recording all of his 7.5 sacks and 8 tackles for loss in his 12 games with LA. Number 24, Kobe Bryant, Seahawks cornerback. Projected contract, 3 years, $36 million. Number 25, Javonte Williams, Cowboys running back. Projected contract, 3 years, $24 million. Number 26, Rico Dondle, Panthers running back. Projected contract, 2 years, $14 million. Number 27, Nakobe Dean, Eagles linebacker. Projected contract, 4 years, $60 million. Number 28, Jamal Dean, Buccaneers cornerback. Projected contract, 2 years, $25 million. Number 29, Brian Cook, Chiefs safety. Projected contract, 3 years, $45 million. Number 30, Travis Kelce, Chiefs tight end. Projected contract, 1 year, $12 million. Number 31, Khalil Mack, Chargers edge. Projected contract, 1 year, $12 million. Number 32, Romeo Dubs, Packers wide receiver. Projected contract, 3 years, $42 million. Number 33, Kwity Paye, Colts edge. Projected contract, 2 years, $35 million. Number 34, Jaquan Brisker, Bears safety. Projected contract, 3 years, $39 million. Brisker seemed to be headed toward a decorated career after back-to-back stellar seasons in 2022 and 23. But the second rounder had an injury-plagued 24 campaign and struggled early in 25 to find his rhythm in the scheme of new defensive coordinator Dennis Allen. Brisker finished the season strong, 93 total tackles, and then had a massive performance that saw him make 14 tackles and break up 2 passes in the Bears' divisional playoff loss to the Rams. Number 35, Cam Curl, Rams safety, projected contract, 2 years, $22 million. Number 36, Juan Jennings, 49ers wide receiver, projected contract, 2 years, $30 million. Number 37, Debo Samuel Sr., Commanders wide receiver, projected contract, 2 years, $30 million. Number 38, Boye Mafe, Seahawks edge, projected contract, 2 years, $20 million. Number 39, Elijah Vera Tucker, Jets guard, projected contract, 1 year, $10 million. Number 40, Keenan Allen, Chargers wide receiver, projected contract, 1 year, $6 million. Number 41, Nick Cross, Colts safety, projected contract, 2 years, $20 million. Number 42, Joel Bottino, Browns guard, projected contract, 1 year, $13 million. Number 43, Wyatt Teller, Browns guard, projected contract, 1 year, $11 million. Number 44, Bobby Wagner, Commanders linebacker, projected contract, 1 year, $9 million. Number 45, Demario Davis, Saints linebacker, projected contract, 1 year, $10 million. Number 46, Calais Campbell, Cardinals defensive tackle, projected contract, 1 year, $11 million. Number 47, David Kinoko, Browns tight end, projected contract, 2 years, $20 million. Number 48, Jalen Thompson, Cardinals safety, projected contract, 2 years, $20 million. Number 49, Kyle Van Noy, Ravens edge, projected contract, 1 year, $5 million. Number 50, Isaiah Likely, Ravens tight end, projected contract, 2 years, $20 million. The next article I'll be reading is Run for the Ages. Indiana's 16-0 season changed the perception of what's possible in college football. But the Hoosiers' title wouldn't have happened without a gutsy call and an even gutsier gallop to the end zone by team star QB, by Pat Ford. To deliver a fitting ending to the greatest college football story ever told, a coach had to make his bravest call, and his quarterback needed to make his bravest play. With 9 minutes and 27 seconds left in the college football playoff national championship against Miami, facing a 4th-and-4 at the Hurricanes' 12-yard line and holding a precarious 17-14 lead, Indiana coach Kurt Kennedy signaled timeout. In the huddle, we're about to go out there with the PAT team, and Kennedy comes out and yells, "Get out on the field, we're going for it," says left tackle Cartler Smith. It got me a little pumped up. The call, a quarterback draw by Fernando Mendoza. What transpired was the most memorable play, not only of the Indiana's perfect 16-0 season, but of the entire 139-year history of the program. The Hoosiers had run successful QB draws several times during the season, often in the red zone. But the decision not to rely on the arm of the most efficient passer in the nation and his elite receiving corps came with considerable risk. Running for 5 yards against the brutal Hurricanes defense was hardly an easy task, and if Mendoza came up short, a Miami offense that was once again moving after having been shut out in the first half would have had the ball in its hands, trailing only by a field goal. But Indiana had no fear. The offensive unit did not hesitate. A big constant that we've really had this year is to always bet on ourselves, Mendoza said. They called that play. We knew, hey, we're going to bet on ourselves one more time at the biggest stage of the game. Cignetti believed the call would work against Miami's defense because of his endless attention to detail. In the days leading up to the game, his staff held a 45-minute discussion about how they would block that particular play. The formation featured four wide receivers to spread the defense, with running back Keylon Black in the backfield to serve as a lead blocker. Miami came out with four down linemen and another five defenders arrayed across the first down mark at the 8-yard line. Mendoza took the snap in the shotgun, set his right foot on the 20-yard line to present a passing threat, then took off up the middle, ball in his left arm. At 6'5", Mendoza has an unorthodox running style, often effective, but never fluid, legs all over the place. He's the anti-Vince Young. Think baby giraffe trying to escape lions. Everybody on the team, including coach, makes fun of my running style, Mendoza said. Never again. The play started smoothly before devolving into an alley fight. Black burst through the middle of the line of scrimmage and delivered the first, but not only, bruising shot of the play on luckless linebacker Wesley Benthetti. While three of Miami's linemen surged upfield, running themselves out of the play, Indiana center Pat Coogan tried up interior lineman Justin Scott. Mendoza nimbly cut right and hopped over Coogan's legs. The first down was secure at this point, but Mendoza had now eyes on the end zone. The quarterback's deceptive speed carried him past two defensive backs. Then it was time for Mendoza to run through Bicenti, who had bounced off the blocks from Black and lineman Drew Evans. Mendoza and Benthetti collided at the 4-yard line. The 230-pound Benthetti wound up on his rear at the 2. Fernando tucked the linebacker. Cignetti noted admiringly. But the collision also spun Mendoza around, nearly taking him to the ground. He reached down to steady himself for an instant with his right hand, then pivoted and made a lunge for the end zone, launching himself like John Elway on his iconic helicopter run in Super Bowl 32. As Mendoza stretched and dove, holding the ball out toward the goal line, he absorbed a wicked shot in the back from linebacker Mohamed Tor. Too late. Touchdown. The last of Mendoza's 48 scores in his magical Heisman Trophy winning season paved the way for a 27-21 triumph. Mendoza's run made evident the iron will that resides beneath his Mr. Nice Guy persona. I know he's great in interviews and comes off as the all-American guy, but he has the heart of a lion when it comes to competition, Cignetti said. That guy competes like a warrior. The warrior quarterback with a heart of a lion and the genius coach with a mien of stone made for a combination unlike anything seen in college football. Mendoza, the number 134 quarterback in the recruiting class of 2022, is a font of enthusiasm and positivity. Cignetti, who didn't get his shot at a power conference job until he was 62, can out-sabon his former Alabama boss when it comes to suppressed emotion and relentless drive. Their supporting cast was populated with lightly recruited players who followed Cignetti from James Madden 2 years ago. Among them, defensive end Mikaeli Karma, who blocked a punt for a massive touchdown in the third quarter, as well as recent recruits like sophomore Charlie Becker, who rooms with Mendoza and came up with two massive drive-extending catches down the stretch. These characters all came together at a Midwest football flophouse, the historically worst program in FBS history. We're 16-0 national champions at Indiana University, which I know a lot of people thought was never possible, Cignetti said. It probably is one of the greatest sports stories of all time. Probably, please, the Hoosiers stand alone. On October 15th, 1887, Indiana made its intercollegiate football debut with a loss to Franklin College, 10-8. The program's tone was set from the start. The Hoosiers won just 4 of their first 23 games and didn't nudge their all-time record above 500 until 1898. They muddled along in mediocrity for decades thereafter, bobbing above and below that line until Bo McMillan had a flurry of success during World War II, highlighted by a 9-0-1 record in 1945. Then he left after the 1947 season to coach the Detroit Lions, and the losing really began. Clyde B. Smith, Bernie Crimmins, Bob Hicks, Phil Dickens, John Pont, Lee Corso, Sam Weich, Bill Malloroy, Cam Cameron, Jerry Nidaro, Derry Hoppner, Bill Lynch, Kevin Wilson, Tom Allen. 14 straight coaches were hired with high hopes, and they all left with losing records. This was the definition of a coaching graveyard. There were 26 losing seasons out of 29 from 1995 to 2023. The misery seemed permanent and irrevocable. Embedded in the limestone-rich hills that surrounded Bloomington, Indiana, never daunted. As the first fight song says, the Hoosiers were perma-daunted for decades. Fans always love a winner, and the state has long had basketball in its DNA. So they stayed away from Memorial Stadium while packing Assembly Hall to support a men's program that has won 5 national titles. Indiana students became infamous for living it up at pregame football tailgates and never entering the stadium, or leaving at halftime and not returning. Then, Kirk Cignetti happened. With virtually nobody excited about his arrival in December 2023, Cignetti went about waking up the fanbase with a series of bombastic comments. The most famous, "I win. Google me." Everyone laughed at that for a few months, then he backed it up to an astonishing degree. "I know a lot of people were like, 'Who's this effing guy?'" Cignetti said in October of 2024, with a Yinzer accent, his Pittsburgh-area roots slipping out one curled vowel at a time. "I didn't care. I'm 62, 63 now. I didn't give a F." I could just detect how downtrodden everybody was. You know what I mean? So I said what I said because I had to get a reaction from them. And the rest is history. Indiana football had 713 losses entering the Cignetti era, the most of any FBS team in history. Heading into the 2025 season, the Hoosiers stood at 715, where they still are. Nearing 140 years of habitual, ritual losing just screeched to a halt. Programs that bad don't get to be this good, not this quickly or this dramatically. Indiana was 7-22 in the 29 games before Cignetti arrived, and is now 27-2 after. There is no comparable turnaround. Indiana likes to tout itself as having the largest living alumni base in the country, with more than 800,000. That mob has caught football fever in a hurry. 8 of the 11 largest home crowds in school history have come in 2024 and 25, and the way IU fans overtook stadiums in Pasadena, Atlanta, and Miami during this CFP run was breathtaking. A team that averaged a school record 51,000 fans for home games this season, the most in school history, had many more than that show up at its first 2 playoff victories. And then, amid what might have been the most expensive ticket market in playoff history, the last expensive seats in Hard Rock Stadium were reportedly going for about $4,000. The Hoosiers outnumbered the Hurricanes in their own stadium for the title game. The scene that night before the game at the Indiana Team Hotel, the Intercontinental, was ruckus and festive. Hundreds of fans, in their cream and crimson gear, filled the entryway and mobbed Toro Toro, the lobby bar, swamping the waitstaff. Beer taps kept blowing out as the demand for alcohol overwhelmed the supply of suds. They came for the most unlikely coronation in college football history, but they had to endure a tension-filled brawl to get it. The Hurricanes' game plan against the Indiana offense was evident from the start. Unleash their ferocious front seven to hit Mendoza early and hit him often. And hit him late, too. One shot produced a bloody lip. None of them produced penalty flags. I'm all for letting them play, Cignetti said. But when they cross the line, you've got to call them. Mendoza never flinched. It was clearly early on that CFP title game wasn't going to be a third straight blowout like the Rose Bowl against Alabama and the Peach Bowl against Oregon had been. This was going to be a methodical battle that required calm in the face of pressure. The quarterback proved himself up for the challenge in his hometown. Mendoza's full-circle Miami journey had captivated the country. He grew up a Hurricanes fan, but went unrecruited by the U and blew up into a superstar at Indiana. When this game was finally secured by a Jamari Sharp interception at the Indiana 6-yard line with 58 seconds left, adding one more takeaway to Indiana's nation-leading turnover margin of plus 22, Cignetti stayed in character. Mendoza surprisingly fell out of it. I first want to give all the glory to God, Mendoza started in a TV interview on the field, his customary preamble before turning to saltier language. There's no better group of guys I'd want to do it with. This is the most special moment of my life. This is such a great group of guys. I love you guys. Great job. Let's effing go. So he knows at least one cuss word, and he was willing to use it. The two priests from his Bloomington parish, St. Paul, who had made the trip to Miami and were on the field after the game, can offer him absolution. I'd say, overall, it was because of my emotion, and it's the pinnacle peak, Mendoza offered. All season, sometimes I've had these cookie-cutter responses, media-trained responses. On to the next game, on to the next play, and now we did it. At that point, I think it was only fitting to open the floodgates, per se. Break my stereotype. He did it, and the Hoosiers did too, in the most satisfying way possible. A lot of people thought what we were doing was a fairy tale and a Cinderella story. It was all reality. We put it on the grass, Coogan said. I'm just really happy for this university. Everybody that's poured their heart and soul and went through some really dark times, we reached a mountaintop. Whether other programs will follow remains to be seen. It's tantalizing for 50 other schools to aspire to this kind of turnaround. If the Hoosiers can do it, why not us? But they'd have to find a unicorn coach and an uber-clutch quarterback to build on. Google the greatest miracles in football history and Kurt Cignetti's name will come up. So will Fernando Mendoza's. They should. The two of them have reframed what is possible. The final article I'll be reading for this program is from AthlonSports.com. Tiger Woods announces status for final regular season TGL match. Tiger Woods out for Jupiter's TGL regular season finale by Dabeyan Biswas. Jupiter Lynx enters its final regular season TGL match Tuesday night, with a playoff berth still within reach. A win over the Bay Golf Club on March 3rd would clinch a spot in the postseason, which begins March 17th. The stakes are clear for a team that missed the playoffs in TGL's inaugural season. However, Tiger Woods won't be part of the lineup. The 15-time major champion ruled himself out for Jupiter's regular season finale, meaning he will complete the entire indoor league regular season without competing. Woods, 50, had hoped to join his team for at least one match late in the 2026 campaign. If he plays at all this season, it would have come in the playoffs, provided Jupiter qualifies. Woods has attended every Jupiter match at SoFi Center in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. He co-founded TGL alongside Roy McRoy and has remained visible throughout the season, even as he continues to recover from October disc replacement surgery, his seventh back procedure. "The disc replacement has been one thing," Woods said. "I've had a fused back and now a disc replacement, so it's challenging." He added that he is still hitting full shots, though consistently remains an issue. "I'm able to," Woods said, "but not well every day, but I can hit them." Woods last competed in the 2024 PNC Championship in Orlando, where he and his son Charlie lost in a playoff to Bernhard and Jason Langer. His most recent PGA Tour start came at the 2024 British Open. At the Genesis Invitational earlier this year, Woods did not rule out a return at the Masters and hinted that PGA Tour champions could become an option. "My body has been through a lot," he said recently. "It's each and every day I keep trying. I keep progressing." Without Woods, Jupiter will rely on Max Homa, Tom Kim, and Kevin Kishner in the regular season finale. The Bay lineup features Ludvig Åberg, Minwoo Lee, and Woodum Clark. Jupiter can clinch a playoff berth with a win. An overtime result would require help from other outcomes. The team's postseason hopes remain alive, but its co-founder, competitive return, is still uncertain. For Woods, the focus remains long-term. A potential playoff appearance could offer a controlled setting for his first competitive swing since surgery. Beyond that, attention may turn toward April and the Masters, a tournament he has won 5 times, and where his status has not been ruled out. For now, Jupiter plays on without him, chasing a playoff spot and leaving open the possibility that Woods' 2026 season could still include a competitive chapter. That's all we have time for this episode of Sports Illustrated. This was your volunteer reader, Ben. Stay tuned for more great programming from Sun Sounds of Arizona.